now, Straight Talk, Murray Langdon on CFAX 1070.
Stephen Andrew from A. Vancouver on him with you. Okay, this is going to be a debate, a climate debate, and the reason I want to do this, Paul McCray has released a new book. He's a journalist and author. False Alarm, Global Warming, Fact versus Fears. And he says on the cover of his book why almost everything we've been told about global warming is misleading, exaggerated, or just plain wrong. And Paul McCray joins us in the studio. Good morning, Paul. And on the telephone, we have Guy Dornsey. He's the author of The Climate Challenge, 100 Solutions to Global Warming. And obviously, Guy, I mean, you have been a proponent of global warming and doing everything we possibly can to save the environment. And he's on the phone. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, there.
I think I've established the ground for this topic. Paul, we'll start with you. In your book, you basically say we are in the middle of an ice age.
Well, Guy, would you disagree with that?
Totally.
Oh.
You can look at the previous ice ages, and the last one finished about 12,000 years ago.
Yes, it did. Yeah, but overall, if you look at the last 2 million years, it's the coldest it's been as a planet in about 250 million years. So we're in an interglacial of a relatively brief interglacial, I might add. We only got about 10 or 15,000 years, and then we go back into cold. In an era when the planet is as cold as it's been for hundreds of millions of years.
The point is that within the realm of human history, when all our civilization, during which all our civilization has developed, which is going back over the last 10,000 years, we have been in this interglacial period, and all of our current ecology and human society is geared to this current period. And the current increase in temperature, as validated by the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, of 0.1 Fahrenheit per decade is heading us towards a warming that is unprecedented for many, many years, and which does justify the alarm bells which you say that everyone should not be ringing.
Well, I don't know how unprecedented it is when at least four times in the last, say, 8,000 years, the planet's been warmer than it is now. You know, there's a Holocene optimum 7,000 years ago, the Egyptian warming, the Roman warming, medieval warming. All warmer than today.
The issue, Paul, is the warming of the entire planet, not of a particular local area. We can have a really, really cold winter in Canada, doesn't prove anything. You'd have a really hot summer, doesn't prove anything. You look at the data for the entire planet over this period, and it shows since, you know, the 1700s, or since the mid-1800s, a clear line of warming. In the back of your book, you've got an appendix, a do-it-yourself climate change check. And you have a website, and you can go to that website. If you go to the website and enter it right now, I did it 2 minutes ago, it says that there is 0.1 Fahrenheit per decade warming, and that June, this last month, was the eighth warmest month in 116 years, and your graph is simply wrong.
Well, I used the NOAA graphing, and I put in two dates. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. Yeah. They have this little gadget on their website.
I went to the very same website.
Yep.
And if you go back to 1970, you cannot cherry pick data. You're claiming you want to be an investigative journalist, and you've put a phenomenal amount of work into this book. I've written 9 books. I know how much work there is to write a book like this. It's really impressive. But it's sadly, you haven't interviewed a single person in the book, not one person for investigative journalism, and you're the alarmist because you're claiming that the solutions to climate change will basically send us back to the caves. And that is absolute alarmist nonsense.
Well, it's just as alarmist, I suppose, and I agree, I am kind of alarmist on that, as the other one that adding a little bit of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere is going to send us into oblivion, which the head of the United Nations said in 2007.
Well, oblivion? Oblivion is your word. No scientist.
No, it's not. It's Ban Ki-moon's word. I didn't say it. He did. Head of the United Nations.
Well, I have to reference that. There's not, you know, oblivion is not a word used in science when it comes
not
to...
Not in science. So why didn't the scientists at that conference, the Bali conference 2007, say to Ban Ki-moon, wait a minute, this is completely wrong. There's a whole bunch of scientists at this thing, as well as NGOs and so on. Why not to say to him, sorry, this is just completely wrong? Because we all, you know, and I know.
Yeah, let Guy have a chance.
Sorry, Guy.
We're fundamentally, you seem to be in agreement that the world is warming, and that is in alignment with all the other climate scientists. You're basically disagreeing that carbon dioxide is the cause of the warming.
I think I do, yeah.
And that is certainly, it is a known law of physics that carbon dioxide traps heat. And it's a known law of physics that the more carbon dioxide you have, the more heat you trap. And in order to prove that the world is not warming and that carbon dioxide is not causing it, you have to, A, cherry-pick the data to choose only the data that you like, or flagrant cherry-picking, I've heard it called. And secondly, you have to really mislead people about what the scientists are saying about CO2. So you claim that scientists are saying that the rise of CO2 has caused the previous ice ages. No one has ever claimed that. Everyone knows that the previous ice ages were caused by what are known as the
Milankovitch cycles. I say that in the book.
And that's well known by everyone. What happens is that with the Milankovitch cycles, when they kick in and there's a slight tilt in the orbits and here and there, the Arctic ice retreats, the albedo is reduced, the ocean plankton grow, and more carbon dioxide is produced. And then from then onwards, after that first period, there's a 90% correlation of the increase in temperature with CO2 following the known law of physics that carbon dioxide traps heat. And we know that since the Industrial Revolution started, we have released, you know, a huge amount of carbon dioxide from the ancient buried fossil fuels, what I like to call the blackened, crunched up remains of 300 million year old sea creatures that we use to fuel our society. And when you add extra carbon dioxide, even in that very small amount, it does increase temperature. And water vapor. The scientists know full well that water vapor traps heat. That's built into all their models. And you then come back and say that the environmentalists are mostly Marxist or Marxist-inspired, and that it's a Marxist inspired desire to destroy market capitalism. I'm quoting from your book now, and that many environmentalists want us to retreat back to caves and are willing to propose totalitarian methods to achieve this result. This is not good investigative journalism. This is junk alarmism on your part.
Okay, I just want to, now, having gone through this, so I just want to go through this and try and bring this down to maybe just a couple of issues. Let's talk about this carbon dioxide issue. Now, Paul, in your book, you say that you use an equation for carbon dioxide saturation. Is that
one of the physics laws of physics is that the more carbon dioxide you put up there, the less warming effect it has per unit. So if you put up 100 parts per million and it warms 1 degree, the next 100 parts per million warms less than that, 0.5, let's say.
Let's just check that. Guy, do you agree?
Well, I haven't got the scientific reference to debate that particular point, but on the graph that Paul shows where he covers this particular point, the range of increases is still way into what, you know, most of the climate scientists would discuss is the extremely, you know, concerning area, because the temperature increase, you know, is looking to be, you know, up to 2, 3, 4 degree temperature increase. The last time the world was 3 degrees Celsius warmer, sea levels were 25 meters higher. And we know that they've been higher in the past. We know that ice ages have come and gone. The question is, do we want our civilization has been built at sea level? Every single port is at sea level. If we want to accept that 25 meter sea level rise is normal because we're burning fossil fuels, then we've got a massive economic cost to the economy. That's why we need to act now to stop this stuff.
Well, you know as well as I do, Guy, that we are in an interglacial, and in previous interglacials, sea levels rose as much as that, 20 feet, 30 feet,
Absolutely.
Up to 50 feet.
Absolutely.
So it's going to happen. An interglacial, it's going to happen whether we were here or not. You know this.
The sea levels rose because the glaciers melted. Above,
yes.
Above our heads, where we're right now in Victoria, there was 2 kilometers of ice.
Yes, exactly.
And so when the ice was so high, the sea level was way 100 feet lower than it is today, and therefore the sea level rose.
Yeah, it was 400 feet lower.
At the end of an interglacial, sea level does not rise. The end of an interglacial, the ice returns and the sea level falls.
Yeah.
There's never been an interglacial when the sea level rose because there haven't been humans around before to burn all the fossil fuels and pump the extra CO2 and cause that, you know, the melting of the Arctic, the Greenland, and the Antarctic, which is where the ocean's world's ice is. That's what last time 3 degrees warmer, 25 meters sea level rise.
That, yes.
The whole of Richmond is at sea level.
Yes, and it's going to happen again. We're in an interglacial. We haven't reached the end of our interglacial.
Okay, I'm going to let you respond to that, Guy. We need to take a very quick
1070
Stephen Ander from A. Vancouver Island with you this morning. We're speaking with Guy Dauncey, who is the author of The Climate Challenge, 100 Solutions to Global Warming, his latest a string of books, and Paul McRae, the journalist and author of False Alarm, Fact versus Fears. Now, Guy, I said I would give you first up a chance to respond to Paul's comments about interglacial issues. You're on.
I think for the listener, it's a really interesting discussion to realize that the world... We used to have massive ice ages, that the interglacials are really only 10% of the past million years, because the glacial ice ages last forever. But we are in the interglacial right now, and there's no evidence that we're heading towards another ice age, and there's no evidence that there's natural melting happening. You quote on page 84 of your book that the Arctic ice cap is returning to normal in 2009 to 2010. Well, every single satellite photograph would say otherwise. You're in absolute denial of the plain evidence. The Arctic ice is melting. It melts every summer. It freezes, refreezes every winter. One of the climate deniers said the fact that it refreezes in winter is proof that it's things back to normal. Well, it's just hard to describe the level of ignorance around that. The Arctic ice cap is melting, and everyone accepts that.
And the Arctic ice cap would melt no matter what we did in an interglacial. Every previous interglacial that's melted, there's been times in the last even 100 years when you could take a boat through the Northwest Passage. It's not the first time it's melted.
Well,
and also, you might note that the Antarctic ice cap, at least in the central part of Antarctica, is increasing right now.
The overall ice, the Antarctic ice cap is harder to interpret. There's less data around it, but the overall summary opinion for the ice cap as a whole, it is losing ice volume. And yes, you're right in the center. I believe that may be correct, that it's growing ice. But overall, which is what matters, it is losing ice.
Okay. Can I ask you a question, Guy?
Yes.
In the Times Colonists a while ago, you had a column that said, began with, the science is settled.
Yes.
And you had some sort of facts and figures in there, and I wrote back to the Times Colonists in sort of an opposing op-ed, and you know, they're not running my stuff these days. It's generally considered on sort of the... shall we say, the consensus side, that the science is settled, there's really no need for discussion, and that's kind of what I'm arguing against. Would you agree with, if I could quote from you to you from a fellow called Stephen Schneider, who's one of the leading, he died last week, one of the leading sort of consensus climatologists. He says, far from saying that we're certain, he says that we end up with a maddening degree of uncertainty. We end up with scenarios which, if we're lucky, give us mild outcomes, and we end up with scenarios that, if we're unlucky, give us catastrophic outcomes. We fight among ourselves bitterly about the relative likelihoods of these and have virtually no agreement. Now, this is one of the top people on this side of the issue, and he's saying there is no certainty. And I've got lots and lots of other people in my book quoted who say, you know what, things are not certain. There is room for discussion. There is room for debate.
And the scientific community is full of that debate. Within the actual... realms of the stuff that people are saying, there's a lot of debate to and fro. The discussion on certainty is now refined as to whether it's an 85% level of certainty or 95% level of certainty. No one has ever said certainty is 100% because there's always uncertainty looking into the future.
Okay.
But so that's normal and accepted.
Yes, but we're talking here, Schneider, now this is one of the top people,
yes,
saying we are completely, there's a maddening degree of uncertainty about whether the outcomes will be mild or catastrophic. Now, granted, why is all the focus on the catastrophic and none on the mild?
Because if you have a chance to act and if you have an uncertain set of futures and you have a high level of risk for one, say we have a high level of risk for an 8.0 earthquake in Victoria, but we say, look, it may only be a 4.0 earthquake, so we only plan for a 4.0 earthquake, mm-hmm, and then an 8.01 come along, you are really clobbered. So we prepare our buildings for the 8.0 earthquake. And so because the consequences, if we get it wrong, are catastrophic. Now, you raise a point in the book which I actually have some level of agreement with, which is that the amount of fossil fuels remaining to be burnt may be insufficient to cause that level of warming. One of the things that I personally have reason to critique the IPCC for, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is that they may be exaggerating the amount of oil and gas and coal left to burn on the planet. And so we don't know how extreme things are going to get. But so far, most of the evidence is towards what's called positive feedback. So the worse things get, the worse they get. In other words, the more the ice melts, the more the albedo collapses, so that instead of the sun's light being reflected back off the ice, it's absorbed by the darker surface. And so there's a lot of things like that. The warmer the ocean gets, the less the plankton are able to absorb the CO2, and the more acid the oceans become.
So that could certainly could happen. But what happens if, for example, when we talk about increasing levels of carbon dioxide, I know James Hansen's Institute has said that the one of the things you're talking about with fossil fuels is that we're very close to or past peak oil, peak natural gas,
no,
peak coal.
No, this is what I mean about your book being poorly researched. We may be close to peak oil. No one has ever said we're close to peak natural gas or
peak
coal.
Okay, fair enough. But peak oil is a pretty major contributor to fossil fuel emissions.
Oil is actually, it's one of the contributors. The coal is the biggest by far.
Okay.
Murray Langdon on CFAX 1070.
Stephen Andrew from A. Vancouver Island in for Murray this morning. We're talking with Paul McRae. He is a journalist and author of the new book, False Alarm, Fact versus Fears. Guy Dawnsey's new book is The Climate Challenge, 100 Solutions to Global Warming. They are both talking about global warming issues. And, gentlemen, I guess the question, you talked a bit about certainty, and I think, Guy, you really raised a very good point when you... We know that there could be an earthquake, Paul, right?
Right.
And I think Guy brings up a very good point. Why prepare for a 4 when it could be an 8?
One of the... Lydia Dotto has a book out called Storm Warning, in which she talks about preparing for global warming as if it's insurance. My point, or my... I guess I object, or not objection, but my opposition point on this is, Guy, I know that you think that green economies are going to be, sort of a big seller in the future, and it's really going to work. Everything I've read indicates that there's going to be quite a bit of damage to the economy from curbs on carbon, so that what we end up doing is we're buying an insurance policy, but instead of 1% or 0.01% of our house value, this is the example that Dotto's using, it's more like half your or a tenth of your annual salary. The cost of moving to these green economies and the cost of curbing the carbon economy, I think, is going to be rather damaging.
Guy.
Well, first of all, Lydia Dotto's book is at least 13 years old, so it's not a resource that all books on climate change are out of date within 3 or 4 years, my own included, which is why I had to rewrite it entirely for the new edition that came out just recently. The IPCC's data is that we're looking to an average slowing of annual global GDP by less than 0.12 percentage points, less than a tenth of a penny, which is 100 times different from what you're saying, which is, a tenth of a dollar.
Well, I do quote from government sources on this, Guy, that say that, 6% drop, etc., the economy.
Which government sources?
Which government sources?
The Canadian government sources?
Environment Canada and so on.
The Environment Canada is currently ruled by the Harper government in Ottawa, and the Harper came out on record a few years ago saying he thinks that global warming is a socialist plot designed to destroy industrial capitalism, which you seem to agree with, because you would say that most environmentalists or many environmentalists are Marxist, which is, by the way, complete nonsense.
I think they're pretty much anti-capitalist.
I've been inside the environmental movement ever since I arrived in British Columbia 20 years ago. There are many, many versions of capitalism, from Norwegian civilized capitalism to the drug trade in Mexico, which is, barbaric capitalism. And most of us have a desire to tweak the system towards the Norwegian end and away from the drug end, whereas the Carter-Reagan, the Reagan approach is to tweak it towards the drug end and remove regulations and let the industry have at it, which is how you get oil spills.
Can I just say one thing here?
Yes.
We have had, for example, the Chrétien government signed the Kyoto Accord, I think in 2002,
yes,
and did nothing.
Yes, correct.
A whole bunch of politicians went to Copenhagen last year in 2009, came away with nothing.
Correct.
If they didn't think that there was going to be damage to the economy, why would they be doing nothing?
It's not that they're doing nothing. It's that the political reality is that Canada is dominated by the politics of Alberta, and America is dominated by the politics of the...
But it wasn't in the Chrétien era. Liberal government.
The
they
liberals,
still
the,
did nothing.
The Liberals only had one MP from Alberta altogether, and they were desperate not to alienate Alberta because of the threat of the previous Energy Act and Alberta's, anger when you even mess with energy at all. I have worked on the solutions in detail for 20 years. I've written 2 major books on it. My current book has won 2 awards. I understand the solutions extremely well, and you break it down into all the various details. And people don't understand the phenomenal benefits we get from greater efficiency. We're spending less energy on this, that, the other. When you move to electric vehicles from regular vehicles, you're actually using only one-third of the energy compared to a regular car. Electric vehicles will be on the market starting very soon. The price of all these things falls with mass production. And on top of that, if you look at the age of fossil fuels generically, over, say, 10,000-year period, 10,000 years past, 10,000 years future, it's a tiny 200-year slice when we're using this fossil fuel energy to power everything in our civilization, from farms to flying, to shipping, to driving. We know as a cast-iron fact of science that the age of fossil fuels will end.
And I'm going to let you leave it there. So stick around for that. Right now, though, we're talking about the climate debate. Joining us on the phone is Guy Johnson. His latest book is The Climate Challenge, 100 Solutions to Global Warming. In the studio, Paul McCray, journalist and the author of the new book, False Alarm, Fact versus Fears. Guy, I said that you would be the next person up, and you can continue your thoughts.
Thanks.
Right now.
Yeah, yes, listeners, before the break, I was explaining that if you take our history over 10,000 years from the past and 10,000 years into the future, the current age of fossil fuels is a tiny 200-year slice, and we're living in the middle of it, so we're a bit like fish in water. We can't imagine life without it. We go to the gas station, we get this funny white liquid that goes into our tanks, and we forget that it's the 300-year-old scrunched-up blackened remains of ancient sea creatures. But given that it's a 200-year slice, the oil will run out, the coal will disappear, the gas will run out. We know that our future has to be from renewable energy and sources apart from the carbon fuels. And I share, Paul, some of your despair with the environmental community in that too many of them are negative in their belief about the future. I actually love the human record of achievement going right back to the Babylonians, through the Renaissance, the Industrial Age. I see the age of fossil fuels as this incredible time when we've built the scientific and intellectual capacity to be able to make solar panels and Facebooks and cell phones and stuff like that. But that very same brilliance will lift us into an age of renewable energy when we can operate the planet on energy from renewable sources, which will have no threat of peak oil, no threat of climate change, and frankly will never ever run out. Once we move to that form of energy, there's such an abundance of solar, wind, geothermal, solar thermal energy available that it'll be an entirely other planet, and it will happen during the lifetimes of most people listening to this show.
Yes, and you know what? I agree with you totally on that. And I know you haven't had a chance to read the book
in
detail,
book, yes.
But I do. Oh, I'm sorry, but I'd say exactly the same thing. I think we're heading for a wonderful future. I don't think, though, and I don't know how much disagreement we have on this, probably quite a bit, but I don't think we need to worry too much about the carbon economy for precisely the reasons you say. We might raise the carbon dioxide level to 570 parts per million. I don't think it's going to cause more than a degree or two of warming. And in the meantime, we won't have hobbled the economy that's going to produce this great new future for us.
We're not going to hobble the future economy, and I disagree with you absolutely about the danger of getting to 550. You're pinning your reputation as a journalist up against the reputation of the world's top scientists on this one. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences itself, you know, recently, you know, in May of this year, came out and said, you know, the warming is happening, that we've got to accept. And they're a conservative body. So you as a journalist are up against the America's top scientists who are all saying this is a major concern, we need to ring the alarm bells.
Well, I think it's exaggerated. It's simple as that. And I've done enough research that every time I dipped into this question, I discovered that there were more questions and more sort of disagreement, more uncertainty, and more exaggeration, which is why I called the book, almost everything we've been told about it is exaggerated, misleading, and often wrong.
Because the climate denial movement, which is well-financed by the fossil fuel industry, goes out of its way to cherry-pick the tiniest piece of data and, you know, and then launch it all over the world. So when there's a tiny error, they blow it up into an enormous thing. Although you're looking at, out of 2 million bits of evidence, you might find, you know, four or five that are erroneous, that need correcting. This is a normal process of science.
Well,
but you claim that environmentalists have always been alarmists and every alarmist is wrong. Well, alarmism sometimes is extremely important. Churchill was an alarmist during the 1930s and nobody listened to him. And he did his equivalent of climate science modeling by sending his statistical spies over to Germany to find out what the Germans were doing and came back and said, I am really alarmed. You know, we got to do something. Nobody paid any attention. We need alarmism when the future looks so prospectively daunting. If we rise temperature by 2, 3, 4 degrees, plants cease growing when the temperature is more than 35 degrees Celsius. They do not just go on absorbing CO2 and get fatter and fatter. They cease growing entirely.
At what level again?
35 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
I
don't think there's any danger that we're going to reach that, but
no,
okay.
But in the summer peak growing season, the temperature in Victoria last year was 35 Celsius. In Ukraine, in the summer of, I think, 2005, they lost 85% of their entire grain crop because during the peak growing season of the wheat and barley, it was above 35 degrees and the crops simply stopped growing.
Okay.
So there's some very serious issues. And when you look at the increase of acidity in the oceans because it's absorbing carbon dioxide, you're looking at the loss of the coral reef. And a third of all the world's edible fisheries are raised at some point through the marine chain via the coral reef.
Well, I don't know how the ocean survived in the past when carbon dioxide levels were considerably higher than they are today. You know this, Guy.
Yes, but,
you know,
but species have evolved and unevolved. We're talking millions of years of time frames here.
The fact of the matter is the planet has been, for most of the time that life has been on Earth, has been warmer than today, and carbon dioxide levels have been, in some cases, much higher than today. And somehow or another, we've managed to get through that and end up with what we have today.
There were no humans around in those days.
Yes, of course not. Yeah.
And so there was no civilization. If you're happy to write off civilization...
No, I'm not.
You're taking a very big risk.
I'd love to keep civilization going.
Then you need to look at where our ports are and what the sea level rise might be and where our food comes from.
And I tell you, it's good that we're in an interglacial. The sea levels are going to rise no matter what we do.
Well, we've been there before, and that is just complete nonsense.
We have.